Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media and WBFO, this is What's Next, producer picks of the week. Highlights of the best What's Next episodes heard during the previous week. On today's show, we'll hear segments from all three episodes that aired this week, starting with...
It could apply to people in a different way, right? Individuals in our community may be looking for training to either upskill for the next opportunity, or also saying, you know what, I want to, you know, transition from this career, I need something new.
Monday's episode with Glenn Aronow, Bacola Morgan, and Susan McCartney. We'll then move over to...
All the students learning about it probably came through a very similar education system. And so they have an equal number of blind spots.
Tuesday's episode with Dr. Marcus Watson. And we'll close today's show with...
We always have to look at what we're doing. Is it relevant? Not just is it relevant to us as an organization, but is it really relevant to the people that we're trying to serve, to the community that we're trying to serve? We're saying empowering communities and changing lives. We have to know if we're really, really living up to that.
Wednesday's episode with Thomas Buford Jr. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for tuning in. First, we revisit a conversation about workforce and small business initiatives in Western New York. We welcome Glenn Aronow, a business services and one-stop center manager at Niagara County Employment Training. Bacola Morgan, a business service manager at Workforce Buffalo. And Susan McCartney, the director of the Small Business Development Center at Buffalo State University. The three sit down with Artrell Williams to discuss the importance of training, development, and local programming.
Yeah, thank you, Artrell. Again, my name is Glenn Aronow. I work for Niagara County Employment and Training, and I'm the Business Services and One-Stop Center Manager. And I oversee several of the different grants that we have to offer, including the Classroom Training Grant, the On-the-Job Training Grant. There's a READY Grant, and I know we'll dive a little bit further into these later. Business services also incorporates anything from resume writing services that we can do for folks, mock interview services. We have the ability to post individuals' resumes on our website for employers to search through, and many other services, but that's a big part of what we do. And again, we can dive a little bit further into it.
All right. I appreciate that.
Sure.
And then next we have Bacola Morgan, which you have a similar role, but in a different place. So if you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about yours.
Yes, of course. Thank you so much for the invite today, Artrell. My name is Bacola Morgan. I am with Workforce Buffalo. I oversee the business services department. Workforce Buffalo have about two main component of the agency: our career center, Workforce Buffalo Downtown Career Center, and also we work with SUNY Erie Career Center. With that is the business service department that I oversee. The business service department's goal is to really support businesses to create opportunities around making sure they have skilled labor, making sure that they also have opportunities for reimbursement to hire new people and so forth. But as we get more into the conversation, I'll touch a little bit more about it. Thank you.
Awesome. I appreciate that. And from here on out, I'm going to refer to you by your nickname. So we've got Bookie here.
Yes.
And we'll look forward to hearing more about the programs that you support as well.
Thank you.
Also on this journey, I learned that it wasn't just about finding jobs, but there are many instances where people want to create jobs for other people and or start something that can sustain them throughout their lives. And so I connected with the Small Business Development Center, and I have here Sue McCartney, who will talk a little bit about that.
Atrell, thank you so much for inviting me. And I'm really excited to be with Glenn and Buki. This is a very important discussion. And again, I'm very happy you included the Small Business Development Center, which I've had the honor of directing for many years. Our organization is part of Buffalo State University, and our mission in life is to assist people who are starting or expanding a small business. We also like to say that we help individuals' dreams come true, because so often starting a business is something someone has been thinking about actually for a very long time. And the way in which we assist individuals is by providing, this is important, one-to-one, we do this on a one-to-one basis, confidential counseling, where we take you from the very beginning steps if you're a new entrepreneur in terms of the things you need to start up correctly and how to develop a business plan and how to seek out financing, to working with entrepreneurs, business owners who've been in existence for a little bit of time. And in those situations, we help people very much what you'd think of in the workforce development area, because often they are then looking to bring on employees. And so that's a whole nother phase in which we work with entrepreneurs, and it's really very exciting work.
It sounds exciting, and I'm excited to have each of you in the studio today. I've worked with Sue and Buki, and then found out about Glenn through Buki, because we wanted to make sure that people know that these services that we're talking about aren't just services available to people in the city of Buffalo or just in it's Western New York, but we've got Niagara County represented there, and then we've also got Erie County. So the entire county in these areas within our region have access to these services. And I first went to Workforce Buffalo, had some conversations, was asked some questions that I wasn't necessarily expecting to answer. But in doing so, I learned that the more information that I'm able to give, the more they can guide me towards where I wanted to be. And so as I was on this journey as to what I'm going to do next in my career, I got a lot more information than I ever expected. And we'll continue to talk about that information during this show so that the rest of the listeners can understand. Buki also guided me towards the Small Business Development Center. So I went over there, and as Sue mentioned, I had a one-on-one conversation. I was asked questions to help me specifically answer what I wanted to be doing, and then was given some resources so that I could go sit down and really put some thought into my next steps in the journey. And so I'm really excited about you guys sharing with me what else there is that I haven't learned about yet, but also what else there is for our community to be able to take advantage of. So with that, I've used this term workforce development as we started, and I'd like, we'll start with Glenn. If you would please explain to us what we mean when we say workforce development.
Right. So many, many of the individuals who come into our center in Niagara Falls, we also have a location in Lockport, are looking for work. And what we ideally will do is either provide them a subsidy so they can get the training they need to gain the skills that they need to find employment, or pair them with an employer. That comes to the, really gets to the heart of what we do. We work, in addition to what I mentioned earlier, with working with individuals who need resume services and things like that, we work very closely with many, many businesses throughout Niagara County and Western New York, to help them to develop the skills that they need in their current employees, or to find them employees who they can train, work with, develop there. We offer, on the business side, one of the primary things that we offer is a grant called on-the-job training, where we can provide the employer who is hiring a new employee a subsidy to reimburse them for those initial training wages, which we have many, many, many businesses who've taken advantage of that. So the workforce development is helping the population get the skills that they need to find employment, get training, while helping the businesses develop, grow, and thrive in Western New York.
Cool. And Bookie, you work for the company called, or the organization called, Workforce Buffalo. And you guys have a vested interest in how that's done right in the city of Buffalo. Can you talk a little bit about what the workforce development in Buffalo looks like?
Yes, and thank you for that question. When you think about workforce development, I think it can apply in many ways. Workforce development, you know, is really creating opportunity and growing people in our community for current job and future jobs. So when you think about workforce development, it could apply to people in a different way, right? Individuals in our community may be looking for training to either upskill for the next opportunity, or also say, you know what, I want to, you know, transition from this career, I need something new, or you know what, I am ready to get back into the workforce. So the programs, and when you think about workforce development, is really the different buckets of opportunities and how can an individual in Buffalo and Erie County area tap into those resources. On the other side of that is business services. We support businesses around growing their current workforce or bringing new individuals into their company. With our OJT, we can support them and reimburse them up to $10,000 for new hires, or current workers upskill about the same amount, up to $10,000. So workforce development can be a lot for different people. For the community, it could be, you know, training and going to our career center, getting an ITA, which is individual training account. And that is accessible to anyone in the Buffalo and Erie County area. And on the other side, we have the business service department that support the businesses to make sure that they can stay here and they can keep thriving.
Okay. And there are a couple things that you said that jumped out to me, and I want to be able to come back to a little bit more, because you talked about not only supporting people who want a different job or a new job, but also people in their current roles. Mm-hmm. And then you also said ITA, the mm-hmm. individual training accounts.
Yes.
Is that something that's also available that is across the entire region? So Glenn, you have access to that as well?
We do.
Individual. Okay.
Yes.
So we definitely want to hear a bit more about that.
Mm-hmm.
I also want to get a clearer understanding of small business development. Mm-hmm. So, Sue, you guys have an outfit over at Buffalo State University, and you help people develop small businesses. Can you talk a little bit about what that means?
Yeah, I'd love to, but I'd like to integrate it into the workforce development also, because all of us in this room right now, this morning, are part of the economic ecosystem. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, we are trying to have individuals stay in Buffalo, mm-hmm. create jobs, be part of our economy, and keep the dollars flowing within this region. We're all on that same page. And so I think that's just absolutely very important. I do want to just add for the listeners that the university where this takes place is the gorgeous college across from the AKG Art Gallery. I only mention that because there are 22 universities and colleges in Western New York, and it's very easy to mix us up with a different one, right? So anyway, we're the one on Elmwood Avenue, and we have 6 amazing business advisors who work, as I mentioned before, with individuals in various phases of the entrepreneurial experience, various parts. And it can be fairly different from working at the very beginning stages to working with an individual who's looking to either expand, grow, or survive. So those are individuals who've been in business for some time. So it's very important. But jumping on to the workforce development, to really tie it in, our entrepreneurs sometimes go through a crisis phase when it comes to hiring people. And we need the assistance of Buki and Glenn and their team to be able to assist our entrepreneurs to be able to find the right people. Entrepreneurs are very often, if you had to say what's their specialty, it's very often thinking about how they're marketing their business. They get so excited talking about that. But if you talk to them about the process or the ways in which you should appropriately hire, train, and maintain individuals working for them, sometimes they find that a bit more challenging or turn that off. So we together, all of us in this room, we are all interested in seeing more growth in the area of workforce development and more opportunities for our entrepreneurs to understand how it's done legally, how it's done effectively, and how they can help an individual grow and succeed who work for them. So the whole area of human resources is extremely important. And we try to emphasize that with entrepreneurs and urge them to expand appropriately.
That's great. So you're not competing with the others.
We need
you guys
them.
Actually, you work with each other.
It's very complimentary.
Yes.
Awesome.
Very much
it's
so.
It's great to know that there's that collaboration because sometimes people don't want to share what the other organizations are doing. You know, it would be a travesty if Sue didn't want to tell us about workforce development in hopes of keeping all the business on her side. But
Artrell, excuse me, think about it. We, for our businesses to grow, which is essential for the big ecosystem advancement, our entrepreneurs have to bring people on. Mm-hmm. Yet my center does not train you on the whole HR process. We do an overview of it, of course, and we try to get everybody on the right legal page about having employees. But after that, we don't provide training to the employees. We don't do that type of workforce development, but it's very needed for the entrepreneurs.
That was Glenn Aronow, Bukola Morgan, and Susan McCartney. We'll now shift over to a conversation with Dr. Marcus Watson, an associate professor and program coordinator of Africana Studies at Buffalo State University. He sits down with Jay Moran and Naila Ansari to dive into the critical importance of preserving and amplifying African knowledge and perspectives, especially in the face of ongoing challenges.
You know, we've been talking about activism, and what role does that play with our students? What are some of the things that our students are currently doing in terms of fighting and resisting some of these current policy changes?
Yes. The question of activism is key. And what does activism mean, you know, is also something. You know, some people, it might bring the image of kind of protesting and you know, holding up signs and that kind of thing. But you know, we try to convey to the students that activism really just means what you're learning should be made relevant. It should actually do something in the world and hopefully help someone. And the broader goal is restoring the cosmos. Okay. All right. So when it comes to our students, there isn't a palpable uptick in their sense that they want to do something in the world. They want to be active. And I think that, first of all, that's the kind of student often drawn to Africana Studies. It doesn't have to be the only kind of students. And Africana Studies is for everyone,
right?
I should say. Right? when we're teaching about African history and culture and behaviors and so forth, all the students learning about it probably came through a very similar education system. And so they have an equal number of blind spots, right, about that, including Black students, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, Black students are learning more about, oh, I come from somebody and we have done great things and we have contributed to this country and to the world. Non-Black students are learning who's sitting next to them, right? Or who's, you know, on the football team with them. And so that they can bring more respect and understanding to those relationships. So so all that to say, Africana Studies is as much for everyone as biology is, or anthropology is, or dance, or any other discipline. So about 2 weeks ago, we had what was called an Africana Studies Week during Black History Month, if there still is such a thing. That's a half joke, you know. But,
I thought we were talking about it. But maybe that's really ancient history.
Right, right.
We know every month is Black History Month. So it's everybody's History Month as well. So we had Africana Studies Week, and we put on several events. They were highlighted by John Elmore coming in and talking to students about policing and the law and how to see things when it comes to Black community interactions with police and proper behavior, but behaviors that keep you alive and so on and so forth. We also had a great event featuring alumni of African ancestry who came, big crowds for those two events. And what came out of that was student interest in doing something. I think these particular students, but maybe this generation in general, they ask this question, what is the point? I've literally heard that question asked multiple times by different people. But even when it's not those words, it's phrased in different ways to mean that. You know, the generation, I think, really wants to know, what is the point?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. What is the point? And they mean everything from, what is the point of life? But in an Africana context, it's like, I get this is interesting, but what's the point of still, agitating for a just world? And they'll talk to me about, this has been done before. We've protested, laws have been changed, nothing seems to stop it. So they ask, what's the point? And so I think, again, one ironically good thing from an Africana perspective that, and maybe just from a justice perspective, that came out of this recent election and the current political climate is that students are seeing now more than they used to an answer mm-hmm. to that question, right? They understand that maybe they've been responding to symptoms of, in this case, white supremacy. They hear about a Black woman is killed in Chicago, but they can sort of say, well, that's terrible, but it wasn't me. I'm still on track for what I need to do. The Tops massacre, May 14th, another thing that it hit so many of us hard, But I think some people, I don't know if it's the way this generation is socialized, but they can still manage to say, they can shed a tear even and say, it's terrible, but it's not me. Mm. Responding to symptoms, instead of thinking, wait a minute, that killer didn't care who those Black people were. So it could have been me. It could have been my auntie. It could have been my, it's that close. So I think they're starting to connect those dots. And these events I just mentioned that happened a couple of weeks ago seem to be a kind of last domino that needed to fall for at least these several students to say, you know what? I'm tired of sitting on my hands. I can see more clearly now than I could before that this does, what's happening affects me, and there's something I can do. The alumni in particular, when they talked about being at Buffalo State decades prior, they talked about being more unified. They talked about using university resources to go on excursions and learn. They talked about being active, being socially conscious. And so I think that event in particular, really sparked the energies of some of these students. And so a couple of them want to start an Africana club, student club, where like-minded individuals, they might be majors, but it might extend beyond that, can come together and talk about how they can change the world, you know, maybe starting on campus, maybe starting in the community here, but that their voices as students and voices of this generation, they do matter. They can make a difference. And that's one example of things that they want to do, for example. Mm-hmm. They want to have a book club where maybe some of the books that are banned, right, are being read, right? Going back to that metaphor from the 1830s of this attempt to extinguish the light, you know? They don't want the light to be extinguished. You know, they want to shed light on, many of them are of African ancestry, but not all, but they want to shed light on their past, you know, and their heroes and the contributions they've made to this country. They don't want that to be invisible or silent. So that book club is one sort of thing, and they're still developing it,
you know, right.
And so they'll have other kind of ideas.
Since we touched on the book club and banned books for just a second here, and I think it might be worthwhile. I don't want to put you on the spot, you know, because you were up early this morning doing your scholarly writings and such. But let's, you know, maybe I'll mention a few of those books that perhaps the students were interested in.
So Malcolm X's autobiography, The Bluest Eye. I know some of Nikki Giovanni's mm-hmm. poetry books mm. are on there. Maybe Franz Fanon, mm-hmm. you know, folks like that. Maybe books that are centered on Afrocentric theory. They want to know, they want to read those things. Again, they're coming from the perspective of they're seeing that we are living in a broken cosmos, mm-hmm. in a cancerous cosmos, you know, however we want to say it. And that people of color, people of African ancestry in particular, Black and Indigenous women even more particularly, are struggling the most, you know, in this kind of cancerous cosmos. And because they're learning that and they know of their own strength and humanity and the value that they can bring to family and community, into the nation, into the world, they want to read the things that help them understand, again, how we got here, what are the conditions we're in, and what levers need to be pushed to straighten this out so that we can bring back, you know, the green grass of true freedom and the love and trust that I think we're supposed to be having for one another. Some of these students who are participating also went on a study abroad program that we had to Ghana in West Africa. And speaking with them about their experiences, but also observing these students there, I could hear that they finally understood that there is a way to be a human being that is based on humanizing each other, not trying to filter each other through categories. You're this kind of person, you're that kind of person, and then getting hung up on, are you playing out your role, or you're not playing out your role, and you have to do that. You know, these are kind of subconscious things a lot, but they remarked in Ghana about, first of all, just the easygoing friendliness of everyone. They noticed one time we were on a bus and we were parked, and in front of us pulled a public transportation. It's a minivan, right? But it serves as a kind of public transportation, like a taxi. A woman gets off and she's holding two heavy kind of boxes. And you can tell she's kind of looking around for help. She's going to eventually put these on her head and then walk with them either home or to a market to sell or something. And someone just, a guy comes out of the blue and he can see that she needs help and just helps her. And there wasn't even like a thank you or anything exchanged. It was just done and he left and she did her thing. And the students saw that and remarked on it. And they would say things like, man, that couldn't happen in New York City. But it's par for course. It's the norm in Ghana, you know. And it was a dream come true to see some of our students go and see and observe things I might talk to them about in class, you know, or I may exude in my own behavior, just being friendly, you know. I don't know if that's the first word that comes to mind when you think of a professor, you know, because it's like erudite and,
Erudite.
And it might even be like even more distant, you know, sometimes. But you know, those of us in Africana studies, you included Naila, Dr. Tori, and Dr. Hawson, and those of us, we tend to have more of an Africana ethos, I think, to how we interact. And so I could even see just being friendly, you know, to students can sometimes seem like it was a bit much for them. Like, are we sure this is what, but having some of them go to the continent, to Ghana in particular, and just witness what friendliness can be. And it doesn't mean it's a utopia, again, that there can be fights and tensions and so forth, but it's happening in a context of interrelatedness, right? So the humanity of people even you're fighting with is never lost, you know. So it was some of those students, not only, not exclusively, but, you know, who are interested in saying, I can now more clearly see a new way, right? A new world. And they want to see what they can do in their short time at Buffalo State to, you know, restore the cosmos to the extent possible.
I'm going to throw this actually at the interviewer. I'm going to ask the interviewee. But you mentioned the Africana ethos that you share, Naila and Dr. Watson. Can you expand on that a little bit? I mean, we're here on the radio. Yes. We can only use our words, but what, expand on what that means to you.
I would say it's a community that's different than what people typically think in terms of academia, because Africana studies is inherently part of the community. So we don't live in this ivory tower. We don't get to do that because we have to have the community involved. And what that means is also engaging with our students as if we would anyone in our community, which sometimes can be a relationship that might seem like mother to child. It could be cousin to cousin. It can be auntie to, you know, niece or nephew. And because we all need that in order to survive. Not only are we trying to survive in the world, we're also trying to survive in academia. And it's so interesting because we talk about humanity. I treat all of my students the same, but particularly my non-Black students, it's so interesting when they leave Africana that they end up getting a little swaggy, as we say, because they, you know, they're invested in the conversations, but they're also invested in justice, and they're invested in all of us being a part of humanity in a ways in which they know that we should be, and that we should have some type of equity and equality when we look at the world, and that we become a family. And I know that sounds so odd to some people that work in academia, because some people don't even know their students' names, and particularly like big lecture halls, but we don't function that way. Like, even in our intro classes, you know, when you leave, you almost get a little teary-eyed because you start to really have these kind of difficult conversations in the classroom that makes us a community, because we all realize that we're in the fight together. And, you know, I say this all the time, particularly with Black women, but when Black women prevail, we all prevail. And when Black folks prevail, we all prevail. And that's the understanding that we have in our classes. And so, you know, I've had some kind of like, you know, tech kind of bro, you know, white dudes and like very suburban white girls, they come out and they're like, fight the power like Nikki Giovanni, which was, you know, some of our strongest allies that are in the community now, that, you know, we've had internships, and now, you know, one of them is working at M&T Bank, particularly with equity and diversity. And she's a white woman. And she came out of our program and is a strong advocate. But it's because it's centered around community and family first.
Anything to add to that, Doctor?
I mean, that was so profoundly said. I guess I'll add to that by saying, because we start with a kind of African-centered philosophy, right? That cosmos idea, the interconnectedness idea. That means that our language practices, you know, are just tend to be inclusive. You know, we have a lot of the mainstream society fighting for inclusion. And I think it's something we do in a way that feels natural, you know. I learned from my father, for example, and my mother that, you know, I like to use we, you know, we who are white, we who are black, we who are LGBTQ, you know, just to emphasize that inclusiveness, right, of us, that comes with a worldview that's associated with Africana studies. But it's more routine and daily than that. When many of us who grow up in around black communities, we know this phenomenon of you meet somebody and they introduce you to their cousin, you know. Only to find out they're not related at all, right, you know, right. From a Eurocentric point of view, right? Okay. Right. Right. And we say brother and sister, like we and this goes back to the continent. You know, it's happening right now as we speak on the continent. Strangers become friends. Friends become cousins. Cousins become brothers and sisters. Every elder is mother and father. And people have obligations based on those relationships. So the way language is used, it's used to bring people in and closer. And if you think about kind of Eurocentric ways of doing the same kind of thing, the emphasis is on, is that your second cousin, first cousin? Is it the third one? What's like the trajectory is outward. You know, we're trying to trace people out, right? But that's not the philosophical, you know, character of Africana studies. So that I'll just add that comes through, you know, in our mindsets and in how we embrace students and each other, and they see us as colleagues interacting as brother and sister. And sometimes you can hear them, you know, talking like they're so cool how they, you know, talk to each other and they're close and so we have community.
That was Dr. Marcus Watson, an associate professor and program coordinator of Africana Studies at Buffalo State University. We'll close today's show out with a conversation Jay Moran had with Thomas Buford Jr., the president and CEO of the Buffalo Urban League. The two discussed the unique challenges faced by different Urban League affiliates, the impact of recent federal policies, and his insights from being in Selma, Alabama during the 60th anniversary of Bloody Sunday.
I always appreciate the conversation, and you come back with some fresh perspective. You were in Selma over the recent times for the 60th anniversary of the Selma March, and I just, you know, take me inside of what that was like for you.
Right. So, on Sunday, we were at the Edmund Pettus Bridge, the march over the 60th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. And that was on the heels of the National Urban League's CEO leadership retreat that we had in Atlanta, Georgia. So just days before we went that. And then, you know, members of the leaders of the 92 affiliates across the Urban League movement, along with our national leadership, Mark Morial, our president and CEO of the National Urban League, we all made that sojourn to Selma, Alabama, to participate with other leaders and other organizations to commemorate and to remember the sacrifices and the journeys and all of the actions, if you will, that was set forth from that very momentous time.
60 years it's been since that moment in Selma. What's your perspective right now, and just kind of where we are as a country, where we are as communities across this country?
Right. And, you know, that time at Selma and just leading up to it showed is, you know, all the progress, all the struggle, of course, and sacrifice, but the legislation that succeeded those actions over time, how they developed, all the practices that have developed. And then, you know, right now, you know, we're in some spaces where we're starting to see some of that progress being challenged, starting to regress and, you know, getting some different attention than it has over the past. So, you know, there was a lot of discussion around that, a lot of concern around what will be the way forward for the progress that has been made.
I'd be interested to hear what kind of discussions were about the progress that might or the ways to move forward for sure. But just again, kind of reflecting back to where the movement for civil rights was 60 years ago. You know, people were stepping out into an unknown and a very dangerous unknown. Was that sense, that spirit, was that on display this past weekend?
There was. I would say that there was quite a bit of, you know, watching the progress that has been made, being challenged in many cases, eroding and challenges against some of the laws, some of the constitutional changes that were made, and that was very concerning for different organizations who participated, different individuals who participated, all being impacted in different ways. Some immediately, some, you know, potentially on the horizon, but a lot of uncertainty as to where what will be the changes, either immediate or forthcoming, either short term or long term, and really understanding wanted to understand that the strength of our systems of checks and balances, and you know everything, and you know just a challenge and trying to see how our democracy responds to this.
And that's interesting way of putting it there. Like you said, how this democracy responds to it, because if we think back to 60 years ago, this is a violent scenario. There, you know, this is a dangerous time. I'm imagining that was not the case in Selma this past weekend. But at the same time, there seems to be this kind of insidious backlash that's coming on a whole different level when it comes to the progress that has been made to, you know, try to bring equity to this country. I wonder if you can reflect on that just a little bit.
Right. So we would think that the progress that has been made, that we would continue to build on that, right? That we would see continued advancements, that we would see the mindsets that said, you know, got to a place to see that diversity is an inclusion is good for all, right? And you know, we know how many, so many different people, disabled individuals, veterans, women, were all brought into, you know, equity with some of these processes over time, and to see some of these rights start to erode is challenging, right? So we just don't know. There's a lot of uncertainty there, all right? And to see this hard work, not understanding what the future of it is quite challenging.
Yeah, I mean, I can certainly respect your position in the sense that, like you said, there's still a lot. We've talked about how in the first but 6 weeks of this new administration, right, a lot has been coming, you know, executive right. orders, and it's almost impossible to kind of keep up to date with everything's coming. But at the same time, you know, in your position and others' position, you can only react to what, you know, what actually happens for sure.
Certainly. There's a huge change in the volume and the velocity of change, right? So we're looking at that. At the other hand, you have to look at, you know, it's changing in different ways for different groups, different locations. When I mentioned the 92 affiliates across the Urban League movement, they're all in different geographies, different right. states, different cities within those states, right? So, you know, they all have their own local responses, and is impacting them locally in different ways, as well as not all urban leagues run the same type of programming. So we're all, you know, everyone's impacted differently. What I will say is that we're being attentive, that, you know, we're staying on mission, right? But we're not being overly reactive, right? We're not going to punt on first down, right? We're going to see how some of this plays out. We might not punt on second down, right? We are going to, you know, see how this moves, and then we will read, the defense, and then we'll decide how we want to move forward.
Yeah, there's no sense in having a fight when the fight's not just there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yet.
We don't want to raise alarm. Now, there are some things that, you know, the Urban League as a movement, not only do we look at services and different programming that we're doing and resourcing for the community, but we also have an office on Capitol Hill, right? So we also look at how we might impact policy as well. So, you know, we have our eyes on all of these, on out of Washington Bureau. We have our eyes on a broad perspective of change that's coming down.
I know before we went on the air, you talked a little bit about coalition building. Maybe we can start bridging into that just a little bit, in the sense that, you know, we can get a sense, maybe, again, mm-hmm. that there might be a certain national spirit, for lack of a better term, that might be pushing back against equity movements. But at the same time, are you sensing that there are also allies who are ready to step up, or seem ready to step up to kind of join in here?
Yeah, certainly coalition building is happening at the national level with historical civil rights organizations from not only African American, Latino, Jewish organizations, labor unions, unions that look at education, you know, educational institutions. So we're seeing that this broad coalition understanding that some of the changes are wide sweeping, in some cases impacting some more than others and more instantaneously than others, right? But if when you start to see that pattern, then they're trying to look at solutions, trying to understand who allies are, try to understand who allies are that said, hey, I'm going to be a full-on ally, I'm going to publicly proclaim my allyship, if you will, and then some who say, hey, I'm still with you, but I'm just, you know, I'm in the background, but I'm still with you, right? So, we're, you know, there's a lot happening across all of those spaces and in different places. So really just trying to understand the landscape of that.
Sure. It's got to keep you going. So when you're meeting with the other chapters from around the country down in Atlanta, what was the sense? I mean, I think you've kind of, you're touching upon it, but let's maybe hear about what you were hearing from other groups and maybe things that maybe resonated a little bit more with you for what is happening here in Buffalo.
Right. So, you know, what we're looking at at Buffalo is, you know, as you know, organizations should do at any time, is really understanding, what's my position and what is my potential exposure. You know, when you're talking about non-for-profit organizations or many others, you're looking at your funding sources, and trying to understand, you know, re-engaging your partners, making sure that, you know, that your mission is still relevant, that you're still able to service the people that you want to service, and that they still see value in that, and it is not in conflict with any of their value, societal or business, and letting them also see the business value of why it's important, and how your the mission that we have kind of ties into what they're trying to accomplish in the community. So I think everyone was doing that in their own way, within their own geographical spaces, amongst their partners, both at the federal, county, city, local levels, and, you know, their private partnerships as well. So everyone was just saying how important it was. And then also within your organization, that their staff is, you know, that you're talking to your staff, communication is key, and that your board members, who may be from these different organizations that have different approaches to how they want to respond or react to some of these recent changes.
Yeah, most certainly, again, we don't necessarily want to compare your board to, you know, other national, like you said, organizations or both companies, corporations who have abandoned to a certain extent DEI commitments, just for an example. So most certainly one of them. But back to then to your board, how about getting, how has it been making sure that everybody is on the same page, so to speak?
Right. Well, I want to say that what we did was share and being very transparent with our board, being able to inform them, and as I mentioned, taking stock of, you know, where is our funding? What is our funding mix? You know, and then, you know, what are some of our other, what do we have right now with regard to sustainability? You know, because you always have to be prepared to weather different changes, whether they be, you know, things, political changes, legal changes, technological changes, environmental changes. There's always different impact, right? So we look at our resilience and our sustainability and communicate that with the board. Well, I would say for the Buffalo Urban League board, they've been very supportive. We have great leadership. We have great partnerships. Those individuals who are board members, many of them bring along the support of their organizations. But, you know, when we chose them, we wanted to make sure that we invited people to be board members who were mission aligned, who worked for organizations who were mission aligned. And so we think that that is a great strength for us, and that is going to, you know, help us be very resilient in this time and, you know, kind of, you know, address all issues as they come, or just be prepared. But again, not overreactive, and just watch out and be solid in our response and resolute in our response. And some things we're not going to change, right?
Right.
We're going to continue to serve the underserved. We're going to continue to represent the underrepresented, continue to resource the under-resourced, employ where we can the underemployed. So all of those things are going to still be mission critical for us. And we're looking to maintain our current partnerships and add new partners as well, who feel that what we're doing resonates with them and is in line with their mission. And, you know, so there'll be some people who now have said, who may not have been partners before, that said, this is where I want to take a stand, and this is where I want to move. And then they might find that the Urban League is a great partner to do so with.
We're talking with Thomas Buford Jr., president and CEO of the Buffalo Urban League. Let's get into them, maybe that concept of partnership then. The partners that you have now, and what you said, there might be others. I would think there are others who'd like to be partners. Why? This is probably something that you have to deal with on a fairly consistent basis. Would an entity want to partner with the Buffalo Urban League?
Right. And, you know, let me just say the Buffalo Urban League has been around since 1927, right? So we're looking, you know, we're on the doorsteps or approaching our centennial. So we've been around a long time. We have a very trusted voice in the community. We're able to get in spaces. We've served people over and over. And, you know, can be challenging for many institutions, right? Just the distrust.
Sure.
Institutions, you know, financial institutions, medical institutions, government
institutions. There's an overall institutional backlash.
Right? So there's that, right? So we're in those spaces, and we can help make those introductions and, you know, say that if they are a partner of ours, then I know that our community respects that. At that same time, everyone's not going to fit that, right? We're not looking to partner with everyone. You know, we have to feel that they are mission aligned, and then that they're looking to serve the community in the same thoughtful, compassionate, and culturally sensitive ways that we're able to do that. And, you know, we serve a broad community.
Certainly.
Right? When we say we underserved, that's anyone looking for resources, who may not, resources may be available, but not connecting, right? So we look at ourselves as a connector, as a convener in many spaces, and putting other organizations together that might not have worked together, giving them a common space to work and operate. And then, you know, from an employment and workforce, from youth education, from health equity. So we're moving in all of those spaces. We've been in this solidly in the housing, child welfare spaces. We've been there. Those have always been impactful. All the way up to the work that we do in entrepreneurship and small business, also financial literacy. So anything from this along this hierarchy, right, from safety all the way up to self-actualization, we have programs, services, and resources that touch those. And I think that resonates with most partners, right?
I'm wondering maybe the kind of conversations you've had, if maybe you can gauge them over maybe the last 3 years. I'm thinking specifically since mm-hmm. May 14th, the attack on the Jefferson Avenue Tops. Did you find perhaps more interested ears, interested hearts, for lack of a better term, in terms of partnerships? People were a little more interested in like you said, aligning with your mission. Has that changed in any way? I'm wondering if you can kind of gauge or grade that.
Right. So what I will say is that certainly in light of, well, I'll start. My tenure at the Buffalo Urban League started during the pandemic.
Hmm.
Right. So we did see a lot of coalition work happening. We saw a lot of funders who, you know, in some cases who come with programming that they support that's very specific, and I don't want to say restricted, but they
sure.
wanted to go and
they have their own. They have their own sense, right? Yeah, yeah.
And then and during the pandemic, they said, "Hey, you know, we don't ever relax that, and we have a trusted partnership, and we want you to use that where it's best needed, right? Or most needed." So we saw that, and then certainly in May 14th, it just exposed a lot of. While resources were there, they weren't always placed in the most needed places or prioritized in the spaces that might have needed them most. So we started to see more attention come to that, to examine not only the incident of trauma that happened on May 14th, 2022, but you know that tragedy, but all of the conditions that existed, you know, leading up to that. Long-term conditions, long-term issues that plagued certain communities, certain populations and geographies that, you know, came or all of a sudden center stage.
Yeah, we had a spotlight on it.
Right. Yeah, right. So, and then, you know, there has been continuous actions. I would say that none of our partners have backed down.
Hmm.
Some of them have doubled, tripled down, if you will. Some of them have become very much more intentional. You know, we need that, right? That we need to be deliberate and intentional. And they're looking at ways to help the organizations that are doing this work be sustainable, investing not only in programs, but also in our infrastructure, right? To make sure that as an entity, we remain viable and can continue to do viable and healthy and can continue to do this work, this very, very critical work that we're doing.
Hey, that's got to be tremendously gratifying and, you know, emboldening that there are, like you said, partners who double down, triple down in right. some cases. I mean, that's got to say something about the folks that you have partnered with.
Right. And, you know, we want to always be able to show them that the investment that they're making in our organization, that it is producing outcomes that are in agreement with what they're trying to do in the community, that might impact, in many cases, impact some of their own employees, right? We're always conscious of that we're being good stewards of the investment that they're making in us. And you know, we think that these partnerships, many of them long lasting, some new that we're evolving through, but you know, we value them all, and big and small. You know, everyone contributes in their own way, and time, talent, and treasure. Sometimes it's funding, sometimes it's volunteerism. Sometimes it's helping our staff, sometimes it's supporting programs, and again, sometimes just infrastructure, right? So we look at all of that as very important in our way forward, and to continue to strengthen us as an organization and making us more resilient.
And that will do it for this edition of Producer's Picks of the Week. We thank our guests, Glenn Aronow, Bacola Morgan, Susan McCartney, Dr. Marcus Watson, and Thomas Buford Jr. If you missed anything, or just want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts, including the full individual episodes aired in today's compilation. Each episode is online at WBFO.org. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for tuning in.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.